Hey, what's good? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, where conversations about work and money make you want a Harlem shake, do the stanky leg, and walk it out.
I'm not sure any of those dances are currently being taken place except for when the DJ says,
throwback! I don't care. I'm living my best life.
I get it. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Pay Balances and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances. Follow our individual accounts at the Marcus Garrett with one T on Twitter, two T's everywhere else on earth. And Rich is available at I am Rich Jones.
I am.
And don't forget to join our email list by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email, where you'll receive our weekly newsletter covering actionable work and money tips and much more.
And also, fam, to you and the world, happy Financial Literacy Month.
I appreciate it, sir. Happy Financial Literacy Month to you, too.
Yeah, so we've got a number of episodes lined up for April, so hope you'll be tuning in every week to check those out. We're going to be talking to a number of folks from the personal finance space, some of which you may have heard on the podcast before, others possibly not.
And we're trying to make you more money in this particular episode. So if those of you who like money, please pay attention. For those of you who skipped this episode or this first 15 seconds, suckers.
And with the theme being financial literacy, I'm realizing that I still feel illiterate in many ways, bro. How about you?
I do not know much about real estate, but apparently it needs to be something I pick up on the side.
We'll have more to report back on that front, but continuing to expand these financial horizons, man. Continuing to expand them.
Yeah, I could definitely see it one day, but I think I'm in the same queue as you. There's levels to this, and I think I'm working through maybe even just learning or appreciating maximizing my 401k and all my investment benefits that are available to me before I step out into the real world.
And in general, knowledge is power. So there are a lot of things that we've talked about or that we're going to talk about in the show that may not be relevant exactly today, but knowing there's an option for you down the road, I think is key. And a lot of the information that we share and that guests share on the podcast are things that we wish that we knew back in our 21, 22, 23, 24 through 34 year old selves, because 35 is where the wisdom is, apparently.
They say youth is wasted on the young.
So who do we have joining us today, man?
Today we have Paula Pant of Afford Anything, whom, after handing in her resignation in 2008 with only $25,000 in the bank, bought a one-way airline ticket to Egypt, spent the next 2 years backpacking across Australia and Australia. She returned to the U.S. in 2010, realizing one simple fact. She wasn't going to be about that work-life balance. Life. Not only did she want a salary, she needed financial independence or the ability to escape trading time for money. She decided to set out and build investments that could help support her and her family 100%. And today we learn how.
Yes. And you'll get more of an intro in a few seconds here. And yeah, I wish back in the day I was thinking about traveling to the Asias and the Australias and all these other places, because I'm starting to realize I like travel, man. I like it a lot, you know, after having gone to Mexico, which I don't know if I'd really call that travel and adventure because I laid on a beach, but somehow it counts.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I think it's actually top five, but I definitely read a top 10 list of things that I'll say mature people regret after looking back on their life, which is ironic because most of them spent their life working, is I didn't travel enough.
Yeah. Yeah, so trying to get all that in before the family and kids and all those other things that people tell you to travel more when you're younger for. So yeah, hope you enjoy this conversation with Paula, and we'll see you on the, I always want to say backside, but we'll see you at the end of the show. Damn it, I'm going with it.
When Paula Pant graduated from college, she did what society expected. She got a job. But like many of us, but not totally like the hosts of this show who are very happy with their 9-to-5s.
Yes.
She quickly realized that working a 9-to-5, even at a job she loved, deprived her of something more valuable, personal freedom. Paula wasn't about to be the work forever, retired 67 life. Instead, she started sharing her story, insights, and interviews on the appropriately named Afford Anything website and podcast, and how she broke into the real world, the world of financial independence. She joins us today. We hope to share a bit of her journey of enlightenment with the Paychecks and Balances crew. Welcome to the show, Paula.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Yes.
I appreciate you being on the show with this illustrious sounding mic, by the way.
It's an illustrious mic and a docent voice.
Yeah, docent. I'm just going to fade to black in the background real quick.
Is there anything else for kind of your opening with your background that you feel the audience should know about you?
I do have to say, hearing my background like narrated like that is really cool. I've never heard my story like that.
That's the Morgan Freeman.
Yes, I totally hear that. So yeah, I guess that basically says it all. I mean, I graduated from college. While I was in college, I really wanted to study abroad, but I didn't. Those programs were way too expensive. And so when I got my first job, I kind of had in the back of my mind this idea like, oh, you know, I guess I'll work for a few years and then quit and go travel, you know, because I'd wanted to travel in college, but I didn't have the money back then. And so I think I was a little bit unusual in that right from day one of job one, I always kind of had in the back of my mind, like, at some point I'm going to quit this and I'm just going to go travel the globe for a while. And my only job that I've ever had, I was a newspaper reporter. My starting salary was $21,000 a year, and that was in 2005. Mm. And at the time that I quit that job, it was 2008, and I was making $31,000 a year. So I never got paid very much in the traditional salaried workforce, but I always had side hustles. Like, I freelanced during the evenings and weekends and saved all of the money that I made from my freelancing to build up a travel fund. So by the time I quit my job, I had $25,000 saved in a travel fund.
Mm. So why quit in travel, though? Like, why was travel the thing that you gravitated toward?
Oh, I just wanted to explore the world. I mean, I was aware that there was so much world out there and so little of it that I had seen. And I wanted to change that. I wanted to go experience different cultures and different environments, different food, different people. Like, I wanted to not only experience it in books and in movies, but to actually go out and see that in real life.
Mm. So I noticed you said 2005. That is also the same year that I took on my first full-time job. And Marcus, was it 2004 or 2006 or 2005? I always get this messed up for you.
I graduated in 2005, and it took me about 6 months to get a job, but I think that was also 2005.
Okay, cool. So we're in the same year at least.
Hey, I was actually exactly the same. Graduated in 2005, and it took me about 6 months before that became a full-time job.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, we're like exactly on track.
I think I need to do some catching up, which is why I'm doing the interview. But I do appreciate the compliment.
Well, I was going to say, because when I graduated, so I didn't really think about anything, to be honest. I was like, I got to work. I went to school. I got to pay off these student loans. I'm going to enjoy life. Thought I was going to be some big corporate title. And what I realized over the years is that is not what I want in my life. So I guess, how was that experience where you already know you're going to work and that you ultimately want to do something else? How did that whole thought process work for you? And I ask that because for a lot of people, they start expecting to go to work and they don't really think about what else they want to do until they get to work, realize they hate it, and then they go, you know what? This isn't the life I want. So you already had something in mind. So how was that process of going to work knowing that you already wanted to not be at work?
Well, I guess, I mean, for me, I enjoyed the work that I was doing. You know, it's not like I was in some sort of job that was like shuffling papers under a fluorescent light tube. I liked the work itself. I just knew that it wasn't enough. So I was a newspaper reporter, and a person doesn't go into a job like that unless they want it, right? Like, there are not a whole lot of news reporting positions out there. So to even get that job in the first place is quite a feat. Like, it takes a lot of work because there's more demand from aspiring reporters than there is a supply of jobs. So yeah, so I guess the short answer is I liked what I was doing. I just knew that I wanted more. And I knew that more would have to come from me eventually quitting and going off on my own. I knew that, you know, if it had been the 1970s or 80s, there's probably a possibility that I would have tried to travel by becoming a full-time international reporter, right? Like, I would try to maybe work my way up to some high-ranking position at one of the major East Coast newspapers or West Coast newspapers and see if they could send me on assignment to another country. But in the early 2000s, Craigslist was new at the time. That makes it sound like forever ago. I know, right? But Craigslist was new and it was disrupting the newspaper the revenue model because they were no longer collecting ad revenue through classified ads. You know, papers were shutting down. They were going on hiring freezes. It was clear that the industry was shrinking. So I could see that I didn't have a future in it. Or, you know, I could have stayed in it and gotten by, probably. But I could see that I wasn't going to have big opportunities that came from it. So that was when I realized that if I wanted that, I would have to create it for myself.
Mm. And so I will note for the general population that the Craigslist website has not changed since 2005. It looks pretty much the exact same.
Exactly.
I was sitting over here with my like eyes up and to the right to whatever your thinking face is. And I was like, is Craigslist still around?
It is.
I was trying to think the last time I logged into Craigslist. But I had a follow-up question kind of as an extension of Rich's, although I appreciate his much more responsible than mine. But the thing that shocked me about that particular portion of the story was that you saved up $20,000. I spent $30,000, you know, not to brag, but you saved $20,000. Where does that discipline come from?
I honestly didn't really think of it as discipline. I just really wanted to travel. And so I had a very strong why. I had a very strong motivation. And so there really wasn't any discipline involved. It was just that I wanted that more than I wanted anything else.
Did you set up a savings goal or did you have like an app? Like, how did you measure that out? Or did you know that you needed this amount of money in order to take that type of travel? Were you just saving up and then you would travel on the money saved?
Yeah, I was just saving up and then I would travel on the money saved. And I wanted to be gone for at least 2 years. That was a big piece of that goal. I thought that there's a lot of benefit to long-term travel. You can immerse yourself into a culture, I think more, you know, with much greater depth than you could if you were only there for a short period of time. So for me, it was very important to be able, when I started the trip, to know that that would be a minimum two-year trip. And so I had kind of, you know what, this is a good question because I don't know if at the time I had anticipated spending about $1,000 a month because that's what ended up happening. But I don't remember actually if I had planned that ahead of time or if that only became, you know, played out that way after the fact.
Yeah, that's pretty precise to say, you know what, $25,000 yeah. stocked away, $1,000 a month for 2 years exactly, and to not run extravagantly over or under is pretty
yeah. yeah, that sounds unduly precise for my personality. So I don't think, so it probably didn't happen that way. I think probably what I did was I just saved up enough until I was comfortable enough. It was probably more like intuitive and emotional. Like I just kind of felt comfortable enough to quit my job.
Yeah, yeah. So in terms of your experience growing up with money, did you have good teachers growing up that helped you instill good habits, or was this kind of something that you gravitated toward on your own?
We never talked about money at home. That's a very good question, by the way. We never talked about money at home. And so my parents were immigrants. I was born in Kathmandu, Nepal, and we came to the United States when I was, well, I came to the United States when I was a baby. And so I watched them very, very carefully handle their money. My mom in particular was very like clipped coupons. She always knew that bread was cheaper at one store and milk was cheaper at the other and orange juice was cheaper at the third.
That's my mom.
She would go store to store to store. She knew exactly where to buy what. She had a vegetable garden where she grew a lot of our produce. We never went to restaurants except on birthdays. And even on a birthday, you'd go to like, yeah, just a place that has $12 entree type things, you know? So yeah, that was how we lived growing up. And I guess I just always saw the frugality role model and I probably imitated that, lived accordingly. But it never felt like deprivation or anything like that. Like that's the thing that I want to underscore. That was just normal. Like I could not imagine a life that consisted of eating at restaurants all the time or driving brand new vehicles. Like that just seemed out there.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because you said two things there that one makes me feel better and number two,
yes, I also felt that. I was like, I feel better about things now.
Well, it's it comes around when like people ask me about the book or how I got $30,000 in debt. They act like it was this conscious plan. Like I just set out to get insurmountable debt. In the same way that I paid it off, they're like, well, how'd you change? I'm like, I just, it was insurmountable debt. So I appreciate you saying, like, I didn't have this big travel goal. I think people are like, well, I need to have this lofty goal. I can't start until it's lofty and defined. And I know each day, like Rich said, each month, how much I'm going to spend each week. Or you can just say, I want to travel for 2 years and I'm going to save up money. I generally recommend, especially now, automating that process. Like a lot of what I think, I don't think about what I'm doing now. By the second of the month, the money just goes wherever it's supposed to go. And I know what's left in the checking account, in this case, is my money to do whatever I want. So I want people to recognize that just because you haven't defined the goal does not mean you can't start working towards it. The other, as far as observation goes, I told somebody else this story. And to this day, I don't know if it's true. My father listens to the show. He'll probably still adamantly say it's true just because it sounds really good. But he told me one year, I think Rich has heard this before, that he was so poor, which he wasn't, but he was so poor that one year he got an apple and he looked his dad in the eyes and all he had to say was, is this all for me? Oh, and then I woke up. And I filled out the FAFSA and I couldn't qualify for anything. So my folks, we didn't talk about money as well, but they imparted, I now realize, a lifestyle of a personal finance. And now that I look back, like you said, we always had used vehicles. My dad has a truck that's probably older than me right now. And I feel like that's something that you can start to impart. Is there any lessons either from, because we have some first generation listeners as well, either from first generational perspective or that you would pass down to your children? Or is there anything that you would change as well?
Yeah, I think one of the lessons that I learned through observing my parents that I would pass down is that we never, in terms of debt, it was never really an option. I mean, my parents had a mortgage, but other than that, we just, again, we never talked about it, but the assumed reality was that debt was not just not something that you would take out unless it was for something like a mortgage. And it's kind of hard to communicate like how it was that that became an assumed reality without actually talking about it. But it was just sort of like the social norm or the cultural norm. And so that's certainly something that I would pass down because I think that was important. The thing that I would not pass down, however, is that a lot of the frugal habits that we practiced really came at the expense of our time. And at the cost of thinking big or doing bigger things. And that is something that I've had to actively unlearn as an adult. It's still the trap that I commonly find myself falling into, where I will spend an hour trying to save a minuscule amount of money at the expense of working on my business or working, you know, doing something that may not have an immediate payoff, but that plants the seed for potential future growth or potential future nothing, but at least the seed is planted.
Mm. So we've had discussions in the past about some of these apps that are out here. I think the one that always comes to mind for me is Digit, which, mm-hmm. as you may know, it was free for a long time. They added a $2.99 monthly fee and people went nuts about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you feel about kind of the free versus paid in terms of apps and services?
Oh, I mean, the question is, are you getting value that is in excess of what you're paying? And if so, then proceed. And if not, then don't.
Mm. Yeah, because to me, it feels like one of those things where people are so used to kind of being in this generation of free, 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 just because that's what so many websites and what so many companies do, where they offer something to you free up front. And then finally, when they do implement a fee, even if it's $2 or $3, people suddenly feel like, oh, I can get this free somewhere else. So they actually end up leaving something that could have benefited them greatly to go for something that's free for, mm-hmm. I guess, lack of a better term, because free is free. So do you have any advice for people who are kind of struggling with that decision where maybe they don't have a clear understanding of what value is? Because it's not always inherent. Someone could think something is super valuable and then at the end of the day, it's really not. So do you have any advice for people in terms of determining what's valuable in their life?
Right. So the first thing that I would say is that nothing is actually free. Everything has a cost. So we'll use the example of Digit. And I'm not saying that you either should or should not get Digit, but if option A is to pay $3 a month, and as a result, you will have X, Y, and Z in your life, and then option B is to pay $0 a month, and as a result, you will not have X or Y or Z in your life, or, you know, maybe you'll have like a reduced X or Y or Z in your life, then like understand that option B isn't actually free. Like, the cost of option B is this opportunity cost.
Mm. Yeah, another way, and I talked about it on the earlier show, I actually backed into it on accident. It came from Sunday Funday, but it's the value to put a number to the hour of your time. So mine that I backed into is about $50. And I came up because I was just having this string of weekends where we were coincidentally going to Sunday Funday. It was spring. I just remember it was just always assumed, or it would be in the group chat, like, come to Sunday Funday. And one weekend I didn't go, and I was like, I didn't spend like about $54. And it was literally about the average of 4 or 5 weekends in a row. And I'm like, man, if I didn't do this just for a month, I'd save $200. So now I'm over here being stubborn. So in my XYZ, I don't see my friends. I don't see Sunday Funday, and I don't get to watch the Sunday game because it's happened to be during football. But that's $50 back in my pocket, or $200 a month to do whatever other activity with. As an extension of that, I'm like, I see these people all the time. And so whatever that number may be, and I'm sure there's several other ways to get to it, I think people should need to know, like, what is your hour of time worth? Because in Rich's scenario, it would probably very easily take you an hour to figure out your savings, or from month to month, start moving your probably more than an hour, moving each penny or whatever it's going to round to throughout the month. And then you could just say, you know what, is this worth $50? If you say yes, that's an hour. Then you can just say, well, if I pay $3, I just made $47. But I don't think most people know what the value of their own time is. So I think that's two ways they can go about calculating, like, that opportunity cost.
To add to that, I would also say, you think about the opportunity cost, not just of the value of your time right now, but especially if you're an entrepreneur, the value that you want your time to be. So, you know, there's that expression, dress for the job you want. Mm. I think the entrepreneur's iteration of that is value your time at the value that you want it to be. Because certainly especially if you're just starting out, you might be working 50 hours a week for a business that's, especially in the beginning, for a business that's pulling in not very much. And when you actually start calculating it, you're like, wow, the value of my time is negative.
Touche. I like that.
Touche indeed.
So you have to kind of think, like, within reason, of course, you have to kind of think, you know what? I want the value of my time to be X, and I'm going to start behaving as though the value of my time is X. Mm. Yeah, and like therefore, that. One day it will be.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And I think that's a good opportunity. On your website, it states the Afford Anything is a movement rooted in one idea. You can afford anything, but not everything. And that's not only true for your money, but also your time, focus, energy, and attention. So either how did you come to this motto, or what do you mean by anything but not everything?
Mm. So when I traveled, the most common thing that I heard from all of my friends was, oh, I would love to do that, but I can't afford it. That's what every single person said. And what was funny to me about that was, like I said, I made $21,000 a year as my starting salary and $31,000 a year as my ending salary. So the friends who were saying that to me, I knew for a fact that all of them, no, I shouldn't say all, but most of them made more money than I did. And also they had nicer lifestyles. They lived in nicer apartments. They drove nicer cars. They got drinks out at the bars. They got dinner at restaurants more often. They got manicures and pedicures, and they went to nice salons to get their hair cut and highlighted and stuff like that. And then they would say, oh, I'd love to travel, but I can't afford it. And so I initially started to afford anything in order to promote the idea that you can afford anything. You just can't afford everything. Every dollar that you spend has a trade-off. And over the years, I've expanded that idea that this is not just about dollars. It's also about hours. It's about energy. It's about where you direct your attention. Absolutely anything that's a limited resource all comes with a trade-off.
Mm. So have you had any hashtag life hacks? I agree. I see that a lot as well. We actually had a guest on the show who's just like, well, I stopped having those conversations because the math just wasn't adding up. But do you have any life hacks for helping people align their daily behaviors and habits with the lifestyle they either do or claim to value most?
Ooh, I mean, I would say first and foremost, get really clear on your values and your priorities. Like, spend some time with it. And if you have a spouse or a partner, this is an exercise that each of you should do individually and then come together to share those answers, because it might be the case that your values and your priorities are not, number one, they might be very different than social norms. Again, I'll use travel as an example. Yeah, I think a lot of people might prioritize living in a nice home or wearing nicer clothes above, quote unquote, taking a vacation. But for me, the priorities are very different. Like, to me, it's that's not just taking a vacation. That's a really integral part of who I am and what I value most. Mm. Yeah. So number one, get clear on what your values are and recognize that they might not fit mainstream social norms. And then once you're clear on that, then you can very easily see whether or not your spending aligns with that. Because if you say that entrepreneurship or starting your own business is important, but then almost none of your money is going to that, well, then you're not spending your money in line with your values.
Hashtag me for years. So we talk about values alignment, and it's something that I've thought a lot about in the past as well. And the exercise that I did for that, and you can find this on the internet on various websites, but there's like a site where it goes, it gives you like a list of all of these different values. You come up with your top five or top 10. From that, you whittle it down to a top five. And then it's, those are the things that you really believe in, or at least your mind is telling you that you really believe in. How did you arrive at what your values actually were?
That's a good question. I guess I just always knew. And that being said, of course, my values have changed over the years as I've grown and aged. But yeah, I guess I just know. I don't know how to answer that.
Yeah. And that's fine, because everyone's going to arrive at it differently. And there's some people that I meet and it's very clear what they believe in. And I'm like, how do you know that? And they're like, I don't know. That's just how I was raised. So it comes natural to some people, whereas for other folks, it might make sense for them to go through an exercise. So in situations where, so let's say somebody's looking at their bank account, they're looking at what they've spent, they've realized it doesn't align, I guess, beyond kind of knowing the values, what do you think the first step is people should take to kind of get those things on one track and kind of get aligned across the board and start formulating a plan for how they're going to get to that life they want?
I would reduce your fixed expenses, your necessary expenses, as much as possible. And so in personal finance, there's the big three: housing, food, and transportation. That's where the majority of an average American's money is spent. The more that you can reduce the cost of those three items, assuming that none of them are your top priority, right? So the more you can reduce those fixed costs, the more wiggle room, like the more free room there is in your budget. And then once you have those extra dollars free, then you can direct them however you'd like. But that's the thing about particularly housing and transportation. I mean, since those are often like recurring costs that are baked into each month, if you can get those two down, you can make a lot of mistakes. You can do a lot of things wrong if you just get those two things right.
Yeah, I believe it's smart asset, but I'll get it in the show notes before it's all said and done. I believe they said housing and car were generally 60% just by themselves. So that's definitely a significant impact that you can have on your budget, which brings me to my question. Would you, assuming it's not their top priority or value, which would be interesting if it was the car, would it ever be so extreme that you would say, because some people might be listening, they might say, you know what, I just got my car. Now that the first two or three monthly payments have come in, I realize that it's 60% of my budget, but I'm stuck with it. In a scenario, same thing with the home.
60% on the whip though, bro? Ooh. I'm surprised they got approved for that. Moving on.
I'm just gonna let that ellipsis, dramatic ellipsis right there. I'm responding to the iMessage right now. With that being said, like, actually, to Rich's point, is there ever a scenario where you say, well, you know what, you gotta sell it? Like, yeah, I know you bought it, it's cool, it's got the rims on it, it's everything that you wanted, you dreamed of, you when you got out of school, but it's 60% of your budget, you gotta sell it. How do you know when it's at an extreme point where it's like you gotta let go of temporarily the dream?
Well, so there's kind of two questions in there. So there's, is that car the dream? Like, is that car your passion? Or is it just this expensive thing that you bought that's eating up more of your budget than you realized? So I'll answer those in two different ways. If this car is your dream, like if this is your passion and you are willing to make hard sacrifices in many other areas of your life because this is the thing that you love most, then by all means, go for it. Don't give up on the dream. But on the other hand, if this car is just this expensive thing you bought and you're not even that into it, but you've already spent all of this money on it and now you own it and you feel like you have to keep paying, you know what? In that case, there's a thing, it's called sunk cost fallacy. And the idea behind that is that once you've already spent some time or money in something, you feel psychologically, we feel the need to continue spending more time or money on that thing. Mm. When in fact, that's actually totally irrational. Just because you've already sunk costs into it doesn't mean you have to keep throwing good money after bad.
Yeah, I imagine that's how a lot of people feel about work in some ways, where it's like, I've been working here for 6 months, so I might as well stay for 5 years and just
yeah,
and just be miserable.
I thought you were going to say 60 years. I wasn't sure where you go with that. I was like,
Till retirement. So
exactly.
So along those lines, have you ever thought you wanted something or you worked towards something and then you got it and then realized, actually, this isn't what I want at all?
Yeah, well, I think the newspaper job was like that, right? So it was hard to get and I wasn't even a journalism major. So for me, it was extra hard to get that job since I was competing against all of these journalism majors who wanted it. But so, you know, in order for me to get that, I had to first, when I was a college student, I would go to journalism networking events. I met the editor of the paper. He allowed me to start writing some freelance articles for them. So I did that. Then I did an unpaid internship at the paper. Then I did a paid internship at the paper. And it was only then that they offered me a full-time job. So I put a lot of work into getting to the point where I could get that job offer. And then once I had the job with my own money, which, as you know, was, you know, I wasn't getting paid a whole lot at the time, I joined the Society of Professional Journalists. I volunteered for the local organization. I flew myself on my own dime to the national conference so that I could continue to get training in that skill set. So, yeah, I put a lot of time and effort into it. But again, I realized that I wasn't going to have the type of future there that I wanted for myself. So I had to let that go.
Got it. And that's actually second time specific to journalism, but I guess it would apply in general, that we've heard about joining networks for that. Did any mentorships or anyone emerge during those relationships where they're like, oh, here's another path, or is someone that you're grateful for? Did you have that, or were you kind of self-dependent during this time?
Oh, I mean, so I never had a formal mentorship. But I got a lot of amazing advice from a lot of people. My editor at the newspaper was really instrumental in helping me learn how to become a better writer and better news reporter. So he was fantastic. And then when I started freelancing, yeah, there are a lot of like snippets of wisdom that come from different people at different times. And I remember when I started freelancing, I asked this one guy, and it was at a conference. You know, I was like, should I concentrate more on building my freelance career, or should I concentrate more on building my own platform, referring to my blog and my pod? Well, I didn't have a podcast at the time, but, you know.
Happens.
Yeah, referring to Afford Anything. And he said, you know, focus on building your own platform, because if you freelance, what's the best case scenario that's going to come from that? More of the same. But if you build your own platform, you know, you can really grow that. So, you know, that wasn't a formal mentorship. That was a chance conversation. I don't even remember his name, with some person at a conference, but it was key in helping me figure out what path I should go.
Mm. So for a lot of people, they're content to work a 9-to-5, and that's totally fine. I always make sure that I say that everyone doesn't need to be an entrepreneur. You don't have to be an entrepreneur. If you're not an entrepreneur, it doesn't mean you're failing in life or anything like that. So for those people who still want to create an independent lifestyle, but they don't think entrepreneurship is the route for them, any advice?
Sure. Well, first, what is your definition of an independent lifestyle? Because that's going to, you know, change for each person. Like, to some people, that might mean working from home or making their own hours or being able to take more time off or some combination thereof. Like, you know, for some people, it might mean working a full-time job as a W-2 salaried employee, but being location independent so that they can do it from Argentina or from Italy or from wherever they want to be. You know, so first, I guess, define what you mean by live with more independence. For some people, you know, it might not be anything that's that dramatic. For some people, it might just be that when they're at work, they want to take on, like, spearhead and initiate projects of their own. So figure out exactly what that independence means to you.
And Along those lines, I mean, perhaps you can give context because it seems like quite the leap to me, a positive one. So from that and setting up your own platform and along those lines, and same to Rich, we try to not entrepreneur shame.
Yo, I like that.
Shame, which I feel like is like a thing right now. So we definitely are trying to do that.
We write down that hashtag.
By math alone, it does create, in most opportunities, if you can, once again, I'm not saying, you know, making jewels on Facebook that no one purchases, but if you have something that someone will buy, it's an infinite market. That is like, just by math alone, just look at Amazon. That's what the internet is. So it's definitely an avenue done correctly where your audience is unlimited. How did you make the transition into real estate? Question mark.
Oh, well, again, so I knew that the three biggest expenses that a person has are housing, transportation, and food. And so I was trying to cut my costs as much as possible in all three of those. And so for housing, my then boyfriend, now husband, his name's Will, he and I were renting one bedroom within a three bedroom. So the rent for our total apartment was $1,200 a month, but we were sharing it with random roommates from Craigslist. So,
if I may jump in, your one bedroom was $1,200?
No. It was a three bedroom.
Thought these were New York prices or Boston or something.
What? Like that. That's still not even close. That's like two G's, bro, depending where you live, man.
Hey. Okay. Sorry. Continue.
So we had a three bedroom apartment. The total was $1,200 per month, and that was split between five people. Right. So there were two couples plus one single person all living there. So for Will and I, we were sharing one bedroom within that three bedroom unit. Right. So our rent was $400 per month. Our share of the rent was $400 per month. And there were two of us splitting that. So per person, that was $200 per month. Right. So that was the rent that we were paying. And through that, I saw. And I'd spent basically my entire life in those types of situations. Like, that's what got me through college. That's what got me through my years at the newspaper. And that was how we lived when, you know, we came back from traveling as well. We kept our rent as cheap as humanly possible because that freed up so much more space in our budget for other things. So that was a situation that we were in. And at that time, we noticed that there was a triplex that was across the street from the unit that we were renting. This triplex across the street was for sale. And so we had the idea. We were like, what if we bought it? We move into one of the units with roommates. So we'd be doing the same thing. We'd be living in a room, renting out our own unit to sharing that with roommates. And then we would have these two other units that we could also rent out. And we figured out that if we did that, we would have zero out-of-pocket housing costs. Mm-hmm. And so that was how we bought our first property, or I guess that was why we bought our first property, is we realized that we could get our housing costs down to zero by virtue of doing that. And then once we bought the first property, then it kind of became addictive. Then it was like, all right, well, let's see if we can save up enough money to buy another one and just rent that one out. And then, you know, one led to the next, led to the next, led to the next. So now we have seven units in total. So five, that's the triplex plus four single family homes.
And is this something that was self-taught? I guess my question is going to end with, is it reasonable to expect that people can learn this on their own? Did you then, as you make those transitions, did you start taking real estate classes? And
Everything I learned, I just learned from books and blogs. And I didn't listen to podcasts, but podcasts are also great. So yeah, everything that I learned really came from the internet or from books. Eventually, like after I bought house number three, but before I bought house number four, at that point, I went and I got a real estate agent license. But that was when I was already deep, you know, years deep into it.
So along those lines, is there any mistakes that you would share now as a lesson learned? Like for someone going in, let's say they want to start next week, they've got, you know, some money on the side, they're ready, they're excited. This is now their new value from this exciting podcast. And you're like, don't do this. Is there anything like that? Or you're like, you know what? Go out there. What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah. Oh, so definitely. So number one is don't value your own time at zero. That was a big mistake that we made. Like when I was running the numbers initially, I would think to myself like, oh, well, if we do the work ourselves, then, you know, the management is going to cost zero and the, you know, repairs are going to cost only this much, right? Because I was assuming that we would do the work ourselves and that the value of that time is zero. And that's just BS accounting. Math should always be identity agnostic. It should not depend on the identity of the individual who's doing the job. Otherwise, it's not math. So when you are analyzing a property and when you're trying to understand if it's going to be a good investment or not, run the numbers as though you are outsourcing every single task. That way, and even if you choose to do it yourself, that's fine. But that way you can always quit, replace yourself, and the numbers stay the same. So I guess that's another way of saying, like, kind of embrace a little bit of split personality and don't conflate you, the owner, with you, the worker. Because you always are going to be the owner, but you may or may not decide to be the worker.
That's something that I would even extrapolate to entrepreneurship, because I can think about, like, over the years, and I've been doing different things online since 2008, but over the years, I've spent so many hours trying to move like a piece of text or like write code or learn how to do this and that, or social media marketing and all of these other things that are, quite frankly, aren't things that I'm good at. But I was so focused on trying to save money in the process that I actually ended up probably costing myself more money in time. Just trying to do things that I thought would save me a few dollars, but ultimately it's creating lost dollars. So any thoughts around that on the entrepreneurial side as it relates to people who are maybe trying to do everything on their own because they feel that they don't have the resources to get additional help, but maybe if they looked harder, they actually do.
Yeah, I've done a lot of that as well. I've had that similar experience with my own business. So I got this advice from Laura Vanderkam. She said, fill your schedule first with all of the things that you can't outsource. And so that's everything from sleeping, exercising, calling your mom. And then within your business, it's the elements or the aspects of your business that you can't outsource, like strategizing, decision making. If you're a content-based business, it could be writing or, you know, podcasting. Like, you can't hire somebody else to be the host of your podcast. So fill your schedule first with all of the things that you can't outsource. And only then, once your schedule is filled with that, can you, if there is spare time remaining, go back and infill it with things that are outsourceable or are delegatable.
Like button.
And along those lines, do you find, I'm trying to phrase this correctly, because I don't think it's simple math. Do you find that there's more hours in the day based on like a 24-hour potentially entrepreneur schedule versus an 8-hour 9-to-5? Or is it that you work 80 hours so you don't have to work 40 hours, which is some other entrepreneur advice that we've received?
Both at different times. And as an entrepreneur, there's like a very fuzzy bleeding edge between when I'm working and when I'm not, you know, so I might be cooking and then I'm like, oh, I need to send this email. And I think that applies also to people in the 9-to-5 workspace as well. But I think it just is amplified when you're an entrepreneur. So yeah, work 80 hours so that you don't have to work 40. Yeah, there've definitely been times like that for sure. But, you know, on the flip side, then there are times when I've just checked out, like mentally just checked out for a month and, you know, things have been fine. So I think, I guess both ends of the extreme end up being true, at least in my experience.
And I feel like that leads into like what I'll call the $1 million question as it pertains to this particular show. Cause I feel like this is a major one that trips people up. And it's, so you've got these bills to pay, whether they're fixed, as we talked about earlier, or you're thinking about going this direction. Maybe you're fortunate enough to still be in school where you can consider the future. All the hope is in front of you. you're whatever the Craigslist equivalent of is right now, whatever. So should people focus on aligning their passions, and this is an opinion question, with that passive income, or is it first you need to find a way to cover your day-to-day bills? Because I think that trips people up almost to the point where they never get started. So do you have a scenario where you were able to either answer that question for you or more clearly define on when do I start? When do I take the leap? When do I pull the parachute?
I think that often passion is the result rather than the cause. If there is something that you are interested in and that you think you could be good at, then start doing it. And oftentimes, once you start doing it, the passion begins to emerge and grow. So my approach is start working in whatever it is that holds like minimum viable interest for you, start working and the muse will appear. And then when you're choosing what to do with that start working part, you know, find the intersection between what sets you alive and what the world needs.
I really like that. And something else that kind of the aha, and I'm having several moments that I've come to recently, is I almost feel like, and it seems like a long time until you're at the end of it, but it's almost like you can enjoy anything for about 10 years. So some people are like, oh, well, that's forever. And some people are like, yeah, that's about right. And I say that because it's actually a phrase that I took from a previous coworker. He's like, man, they got the golden handcuffs on you. So you get to this job. Generally out of school, I stumbled into mine like most people, started chasing money because I thought that's where happiness was. And then you get to the other side of the rainbow, you're 10 years in and you're making too much money or you're too senior to leave. And the funny scenario there is, well, people are like, well, you can just quit. And technically, well, it's actually you can't quit. It's the transition that becomes more difficult because I'm like, you know what? I'm a millennial. You know, we take these slasher jobs. We have 7 jobs before we're 35. I'll just look for another job. And there's literally been interviews where they're like, you know, we're hiring in that department you work in right now. And I'm like, I am trying to get out of there. It's like the mafia. It's like this blood in, blood out thing. Like, I'm like, yo, I'm trying to transition. They're like, why? You've been doing it for 10 years. I'm like, your question is the answer. And so I share that, you know, haphazard story for, because I think folks, they get into a career, they're like, I love it, I enjoy it right now. And I think I would be hesitant to not either immerse yourself or consider other options, especially when it comes to that passion, because I didn't go into my career because I was passionate about it. I went into it because I'm like, I have bills to pay, you know, school loans, credit cards, in my case, to pay off. I didn't even really have a clear insight of what I wanted to do. And then I'm actually 15 years into it now. People are like, well, like Rich said, you know, you're going to do it for another 30 years. So good luck with that. But I think I have some avenues where I can divest, I guess, my interest. But I would share with people to be careful with, I'm trying to be nice here, but not to become complacent in your current contentment. So as that timeline starts to roll out, have you either seen that in yourself or seen that in others where they're like, they loved it, and then either the passion or the fire burned out and now they're kind of on the other side of that candle? And if so, how did they escape it? I'm hoping there's a happy ending here.
Yeah. So I would say the number one thing that you can do in order to give yourself the opportunity to escape it is to grow the gap between what you earn and what you spend and then invest that gap. And the more that you do that, the bigger your investments become, and eventually they'll get to the point where those investments are a strong safety net, which means that if you do burn out, you know, if you've been doing something for 10 years and you realize you just don't want to be in this anymore and you want to make some type of a career change, you have that safety net, that cash safety net that can hold you through that career change. Because the career change might be that you go back to school. It might be that you're unemployed for a while you're looking for other jobs. It might be that you take a job with a significant pay cut in something that you think is more interesting. Like, that career change could be anything. But having a strong safety net that can kind of hold you through that career change is going to give you freedom. So that's the number one thing that I would say. Like, the concept of financial independence, my definition of it is when your investments are strong enough that you can live fearlessly. You know, so your investments provide enough passive income that you know that you'll be taken care of no matter what. You may not be living in luxury, but you know that, you know, you'll have a roof over your head, you'll have food, you'll have electricity. And when you can get your investments to the point where you can meet at least basic needs, I think you'll have a lot more confidence to then do whatever it is that you want to do.
Yes, I agree. I'm really glad you say that, because what I would say to people is it maximizes your options. Mm-hmm. And options are like oxygen. You don't realize you miss it until it's gone. So, you know, those investments give you just other options. Even if you know what, I'm different than Richard Marcus and Paula, I'm going to work 67 years at one job and I'll teach them. You know, you have these investments as those options just in case that plan takes a different path or fork in the road down the line. Which brings me to, unfortunately, my near last question, because this has been another great interview. But for most people, what do you believe is or will be their biggest obstacle to reaching that financial independence?
However they define it, of course.
Of course.
Well, I think there are two ways to answer this question, depending on your income level. For some people, the problem will be that they don't earn enough. And for others, the problem will be that they allow their expenses to rise to meet whatever it is that they're earning. So, you know, I think there are a lot of people in the personal finance space who like to hug one answer or the other. You know, there are a lot of people who say, just stop spending as much. And if you stop spending, then, you know, you can save more. And then once you invest those savings, you'll reach financial independence. And that's true, assuming that you are making decent money to begin with. If you're not, however, then it might be the case that you don't have a spending problem. You have an income problem. So that's the reason that I like to say grow the gap between what you earn and what you spend, because then it's not about earning more versus spending less. Then it's just about growing the gap.
So we're not going to be able to hit the blog topics, but I'll drop some in the show notes that I thought were interesting. At least some that I've grabbed here is renting is throwing away money. Right. Rod Burgundy question mark.
Spoiler alert, it is not.
Exactly. Holding you back. And is there any other like blogs that you either the fan favorites or ones that you want to recommend for our listening audience?
Ooh, there's one called 12 Essential Lessons on Money and Life that I think is one of my favorites.
Cool.
And I'll get that in the show notes for the people.
Cool. Yeah. And there was one that 8 Money Myths Holding You Back. Mm-hmm. Is another one that I was taking a look at that I think will be beneficial to people, because I think just naturally people find excuses and reasons to not do things, because that's the easier option, is to find reasons for why you can't have or why you can't do versus why you can. So I encourage people to make sure that they check that one out as well.
Excellent. Excellent. And with the Afford Anything podcast, podcast episode number 87 is one of my favorites. That one is also around the theme of kind of myths and limiting beliefs that we have around money.
Cool.
All right. Thank you for joining us. And where can the audience find you around the interwebs?
So you can check out the Afford Anything podcast. Just search for Afford Anything in your favorite podcast player and hit subscribe so that you can get a new episode every week. And then on the internet, I am at affordanything.com.
Awesome.
Thank you for joining us, Paula.
Yeah, it's been great having you on the podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for inviting me on.
I have a lot of notes scribbled here, which I trust myself, past self, and future me will have these endorsed in the show notes. So I know you are impressed with the amount of show notes that I got in there with all the hyperlinks that were referenced in the show. I'm hoping someone isn't doing an audit of this one day and they're like, man, he mentions like 3 things a show that don't make the show notes because I have the memory of a small goldfish, but not this time. Ain't that right, future self? That's right, Marcus. What's up?
Yeah, I was trying, man, because we hit on so many different things between the real estate, the entrepreneurship, the good financial habits, values, a lot to think about. And there are some things that are super relevant to what's happening in life that I wanted to jump in. And I was like, if I keep jumping in with this, it's going to be like an hour and a half show. So yeah. I kept some of those things to self and we'll probably revisit them on a future episode or maybe with one of the upcoming guests, depending how that goes. So if you enjoyed today's episode or found it useful, be sure to share with your network and hit us with those 5 stars in Apple Podcasts and say a few words about the show. We appreciate it muchly. And the more people we reach, the more people we help. So your words not only, you know, help us feel good and all of that, but also it lets new people know who are checking out the show, what we're about, why they should listen, why they should have PNB in their life.
And along those lines, today's 5-star review, I think I said along those lines about 6 times on this show. You know what? I recognize that, you know, new year, new me, and I'm still improvement. Comes from That's So Boss. 5 stars.
Bounce.
Good for all working professionals. ! Used correctly. Great career and financial advice served up in a digestible, engaging format for any age group, but particularly those just starting out our mid-career.
Why'd you finish it like that?
I had to jump in with my legalese voice. That's where, you know, you drop in all the facts.
So that's So Bows. We appreciate that 5-star review. And yeah, as we mentioned up top, if there are questions, topics, comments that you want to share with us, hit us at info@paychecksandbalances.com. Anything else you want to mention before we wrap up, fam?
Enjoy your financial literacy month.
Yes. Until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.